this point is that we're going to do the literary this week, next week, and some summary next week of what we've seen about Shir HaShirim. That's going to be December 20th. Then we'll be off for two Tuesdays. So we'll be off December 27th, and we'll be off on January 3rd, which is also the fast day of the 10th of Teves. And we'll restart on January 10th. In terms of, there was something else I was going to mention. All right, I don't remember. There was something else I was going to say, but I don't remember what it was. But that's the schedule, is where we're on next week, and then we're off for two Tuesdays. And after that, we're going to start the book of Mishlei. Clear? Okay. So we're approaching now the literary layer of this book, and I started on it at the very end last time, but I want to take a little bit more time to explain what we mean when we talk about the literary reading of Shir HaShirim. You know, we talked a lot in the beginning about Midrashim and how Midrash analyzes the text with a great ear for language, and it identifies what are often called literary elements. The images that are used, the tone that's used, the word choice that's used, and it teaches lessons from them, and it really resembles a close literary analysis of the text. The difference between what Medrash does and what people usually think of as literary analysis is that, number one, Medrash approaches Shir HaShirim and, you know, all of Tanakh as having been written at least with Ruach HaKodesh, if not Nevuah, prophecy. Number two, Medrash draws on a Mesorah framework, a framework of tradition, and it is taught by what are called Baalei Mesorah, those who transmit that tradition, who are expert in all aspects of Torah. So it's not, you know, that's where it deviates from somebody looking at the text and saying, well, I think that this image is used because it symbolizes such and such. What I think may be correct, and may reflect a deep understanding of the book, but it's not the same thing in the end as Medrash. But we have seen in the past several decades rabbis and others who have begun to read Tanakh with an eye toward analyzing literary elements, and it's been applied to Shir HaShirim. Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, in an article that I want to refer to later, brings the Rambam on this point. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, this is from the Rambam's introduction to the Mora Nebuchim, to the Guide of the Perplexed. It's from that Friedlander translation that's available online. He says, the key to the understanding and to the full comprehension of all that the prophets have said is found in the knowledge of the figures, their general ideas, and the meaning of each word they contain. You have to know who the prophets are, you have to know their ideas, and you have to know the meaning of their words. And he quotes the verse, I have also spoken in similes by the prophets, and also the verse, put forth a riddle and speak a parable, meaning the prophets are themselves instructed to speak in parables and metaphors and images. And because the prophets continually employ figures, meaning mishalim, Yechezkel said, does he not speak parables? Doesn't God speak in parables? Again, Solomon begins his book of Proverbs with the words, to understand a proverb and figurative speech, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. So there is a need to interpret the metaphors that are used, the images that are used. I think when I said in the beginning, when he says is found in the knowledge of the figures, their general ideas, figures doesn't mean the prophets. Figures means the mashal. The parable is, or the metaphor is, that's being used. So the Rambam supports this drive to understand the imagery that's used, the word choice that's used, and so on. So what I want to do is to look at the nature imagery that's in the book, because I think that can teach us particular things. I want to look at the images that the Dod and the Ra'aya use when they describe each other. What do they compare each other to? And the overall structure of the relationship between them as portrayed in the book. And all of this, I hope, will make more sense once we actually do it. but that's what I want to do here. One note, and I see your hand, Sandra. One note that I think is important to understand is there is no duty to accept everything said in a literary analysis. A lot of it is based on what the reader brings to the table in terms of knowledge of Tanakh, sensitivity to the text, and more. So when we're going to see what Rav Moshe Lichtenstein does as an example, I'm going to tell you at one point I'm not entirely sold on what he's saying. That's okay when you're dealing with a modern literary analysis. Someone notices something, tries to explain the meaning. Maybe it's more convincing, maybe it's less convincing. That happens. Sandra.
If we are to understand the message of the prophet, why does it have to be in parables? Why can't it be straightforward?
Good question. What's the answer? Why do we need parables at all? Why can't the prophet just say what he's thinking?
Well, I thought that, you know, a different message for every generation. Like, things are not always the same. I don't know.
So you're saying if we use a parable, then it's a little more malleable.
Yes, exactly.
Could be.
I can't think of any other reason, because it's frustrating to open up something and not be able to understand it because the Lashon is in parables or the Lashon is in ordinary English.
Right. No, and I hear you. But a couple of things. Number one, I think that parables and images can often convey something that a simple statement does not. It's more dramatic and more effective and more memorable. Of course, you have to understand it in order for to get there.
Exactly, because when when Nathan tells David about the poor man and the sheep,
yeah,
it's really hits home. But it's something that we can understand. But when they talk in funny language and everything is all sort of, I don't know.
Right.
Like for example, Ishayahu, the end of Ishayahu is not as intelligible to somebody like me as the beginning of Ishayahu.
That's funny, because I thought the beginning of Ishayahu was pretty hard. So I would note a few things here, and I see Chana's hand also. Number one, the parables usually, and I'm not talking only about Shir HaShirim, I'm talking about Tanakh, parables usually do not obscure the overall meaning. They tend to add details and strength, but I can still read it and understand what's going on. I can read Shir HaShirim straight and understand that there's some kind of love or desire for love from the Raya towards the Dod and reaching him, not reaching him, without grasping the nuances of the particular metaphors that are being used. I might lose elements of meaning, but I can still grasp it. Number two, very important to realize, we talked about this when we did Ralbag and Malbim. They suggested that this is meant to be a book designed for the elite. It's not meant for everybody, and that the use of the parable is to keep it obscure in order to make sure that people will not necessarily understand unless they are initiates, unless they're really meant to be the readers of the book, in which case they'll understand it. So I think that's also important to remember. Sometimes the use of mashal obscures things intentionally. Chana, you were going to say?
Actually, what I was going to say is that you, the opposite of what you just said.
Excellent.
To me, I take from Mishlei, this always resonates with me. Tapuchei zahav masgiot hakesef.
Yep.
Now, the zahav is harder to reach than the silver. And I think that the mashal is much more tangible, and sometimes the idea is very abstract, and sending the mashal maybe. So it's the opposite of what you said. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, that can help. It's absolutely true. Sometimes the dramatic and graphic is helpful as opposed to the obscure idea. Certainly, if I take the layer of Ralbag and Malbim, which we really, really struggled to understand about the intellect and all of that, the mashal is a lot easier to understand than the nimshal. Yeah, trying to tell me about it directly makes it much harder to understand. So yes, that is true. There's a lot to be said about use of metaphor, but I think that overall, believe it or not, it's meant to help rather than to hinder as a general principle, except where, in fact, it is meant to hinder, where it's meant to make things a little bit harder to grasp, which happens to be the book we're reading. I will tell you, though, for those who are frustrated with Mashal, the next book, Mishle, the parables are very easy to understand. So easy that we're going to wonder why Shlomo even bothered. But we'll get there when we get there. Okay. So, as I said last time, in order for us to gain an appreciation of the literary layer, we need to make sure we understand the basic book. And so I gave you on your sheet an outline of Shir HaShirim. This is built on the outline that I gave when we did our introductory 2 weeks on Shir HaShirim. I've added where we saw Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Malbim disagree about something, because those were the three for whom we had a complete read of the book. So I showed you here where they disagree with each other. But I don't really want to spend time on where they disagree with each other. That's not my point. My point really is just that after we do this outline, you will have in your head a complete picture of the book. That's what I'm going for. So phase one of the book, which is chapter one into chapter two, is an introduction to this love relationship. It begins with the Raya talking about how she loves the Dod and she wants to find him. And the Dod responds, "Go out with the sheep and shepherd your young goats." It's like he's not interested. Go do something else instead of pursuing me. There's something else you need to do. And we saw Rashi and Ibn Ezra about what this was, what did God want of us, and the Malbim's approach to how to find God. Fine. That was followed by songs of praise for each other. The Dod speaks of the beauty of the Raya speaks of the beauty of the Dod, and the Raya turns to the daughters of Jerusalem and says, "The Dod loves me, and I want you to swear not to do anything to the love." Meaning, as Rashi and Ibn Ezra understood it, don't try to lead us astray. Or, as the Malbim says, also, the body shouldn't lead Shlomo away from God, or try to draw Shlomo to God too early when it's inappropriate. But either way, it's a warning of, don't mess with this relationship. That's your first part of the book. There is love between them, but the Dod is a little standoffish. And the Raya says to these outsiders, daughters of Jerusalem, don't mess with things, don't get in the way. Got it? That's your opening of the book. Then you get to phase two, which completes chapter two and goes into chapter three. And that speaks of a lost opportunity. The Raya was pursuing the Dod. The Dod calls to the Raya from behind the wall. You expect the Ra'ya to go to the Dod, but she doesn't. She says something about taking foxes until the end of the day. And we had different explanations. One explanation was that it was about asking God to eliminate the Egyptians. Ibn Ezra says it's God's command to us to eliminate those who serve the Egel, the golden calf. The Malbim said, well, I'm not even going to go into it. It's Shlomo's soul distracting the material aspects, you know, by getting them involved in physical activities, they won't be distracted from God. Something weird is going on with this line, but the bottom line is that the Ra'ya does not go to the Dod. And the Ra'ya then describes dreaming of finding the Dod, but she didn't actually make it. There was a lost opportunity. So Ra'ya pursues Dod in the beginning of the book. Dod isn't ready. Dod comes for the Ra'ya. Ra'ya isn't ready. And then you have an interlude, the rest of chapter 3, which has a description of the beauty of the Ra'ya and the majesty of Shlomo, of King Solomon. That seems to be about a positive time. As you see, Rashi says the Jews are traveling with the Mishkan, the tabernacle of God. Ibn Ezra, the Jews are entering Israel. The Malbim reads it as King Solomon finding God via the Beis HaMikdash he built. And things seem to be on a good track. We're going to get together. And then you get to chapter 4, through the beginning of chapter 6, the turning point of the book. The Dode, again, is interested in the Ra'aya. She is so beautiful. He wants to be with her. He comes to her and he knocks on the door. And the Ra'aya fails to respond, right? Kol Dodi Dofek, she hears the knocking, but she doesn't get up. She says, I've already bathed. I already put on my tunic. I'm not getting up out of bed. And then she misses him and she goes out to look for the Dode and she is attacked by the guards of the city. The guards being, you know, again, Rashi, the Babylonians, Ibn Ezra, the Greeks, the different views. She says to them, I want to find my Dode. And they say, why? What's your Dode? And she talks about how beautiful and wonderful and handsome her Dode is. And then we're told the Dode descends to his garden and the Ra'aya expresses her love for the Dode. What's going to happen now in our story? He came for her multiple times and she said no, or she wasn't ready, or she got distracted. Well, that brings us to chapter 6 and 7, and the Dode says, I am still interested. The Dode describes the beauty of the Ra'aya. The Ra'aya is supposed to be in the garden with the Dode, but she doesn't know what to do. And the Dode still praises the beauty of the Ra'aya. Which brings us to phase 5, end of chapter 7. The Ra'aya pursues the Dode. She says, I want you to be with me. I wish you were like my brother. We could be together always. And ultimately that evolves into what seems like a positive, loving relationship at the end, where the Dode and the Ra'aya are together. That's how some read the ending. There are other ways to read the ending, but that's one way to read the ending, and it's consistent with the commentators we've read. Okay? So this is a story with a lot of ups and downs. And you can easily see, when you read this, why the commentators jump to say it's the story of the Jews' relationship with Hashem. Right? Because isn't that our history? Right? God calls to us, we're not ready. God calls to us, we're not ready. Then we're ready, and God says, well, you're not ready yet. And this back and forth, and God saying, I'll give you another chance, and I'll give you another chance. It fits very well. You can also understand why it would be read as the story of the individual's relationship with God. Because that happens to us personally as well. We go through this process. We do tshuva, we repent, then we come to God, and then we make another mistake. Over and over and over again, we do this cycle. Clear? Okay? All right. So with this, you know, as background, I want to show you first messages in the nature imagery in Shir HaShirim. Very interesting stuff, to me at any rate, hopefully to you as well. First of all, the image of the Tzvi and Ayal. So on your sheet, I translate Tzvi as a deer. Others will translate it as a gazelle. It's some kind of graceful, quick creature that runs around on four legs. And we don't want to see hunted, right? That's basically what we're talking about. That's a tzvi. An ayal is often translated as a heart, and that's what I went with. If you asked me to draw a heart, if you asked me, like, to pick a heart out in a lineup, I couldn't do it. But also, it's one of these gazelle-type, you know, creatures. The deer and the heart. It's very interesting to see how this pair shows up in Shir HaShirim. They show up 4 times in the book of Devarim together, each time as an example of kosher animals. Not exactly the way I would have thought of them, you know, in Shir HaShirim, right? We're not talking dinner in Shir HaShirim. Nonetheless, that's where they get used in the book of Devarim. They also show up in something we read last year, the 5th chapter of the book of Malachim, when it's describing the food at Shlomo's table. So Tzvi and Ayal show up there as well. And that's it in Tanakh, except for Shir HaShirim. And in Shir HaShirim, they show up no fewer than 7 times as a pair. I gave you in the bullet points in source number 2 a breakdown of the times they appear. Shir HaShirim chapter 2, sentence 7, and chapter 3, sentence 5, are 2 of the oaths Hishvati eschem benos Yerushalayim. I make you swear, daughters of Jerusalem, b'tzvaos, o ba'aylos hasadeh. In the tzvaot, that's plural of deer here, and aylot hasadeh, the ayal, the hearts. So there are two oaths by the tzvi and ayal. Commentators explain, yeah, there are a lot of different layers to reading them. Like, what are they doing with the oath? What do they have to do with the oath? So one read is, if you violate your oath, you will be abandoned for eating, like the tzvi v'ayal. If you don't stick to the oath, this should happen to you. You follow? I don't want to go too quickly with this, because it'll all be lost if I do. The primary appearance of Tzvi and Ayal in Shir HaShirim is when the Ra'aya compares her dod to the Tzvi or to Ofer HaAyalim. Ofer is a young heart, specifically. Not young at heart, but a young heart. Speaking of young at heart, happy birthday, Joyce. I forgot to mention that. But if you take a look in Shir HaShirim at chapter 2, sentence 9, we should see examples of this. The Ra'aya says, Dome dodi litzvi, o la'ofer ha'ayalim. My beloved, my dod, is like a tzvi, or like ofer ha'ayalim, the heart. And he's standing behind the wall, he's looking from the windows, and so on. Chapter 2, sentence 17. She says, the Ra'aya says, Sov demelecha dodi litzvi ola ofer ha'ayalim. Once again, she says, demelecha dodi litzvi. My beloved, resemble, it's an instruction, to a tzvi or to ofer ha'ayalim. And then you get it again, almost the very end of the book. Chapter 8, sentence 14. No, it is the very end, actually. It is the last verse. Barach dodi, flee, my beloved, udmei lecha litzvi, and resemble a tzvi ola ofer ha'ayalim, or one of these hearts, the young hearts. So there's an image of comparing the beloved to it, and then there are two more references, chapter 4, sentence 5, chapter 7, sentence 4, in which the dod compares part of the ra'aya to shnei ofarim ta'omei tziviya, to two young hearts matching young deer, or gazelle, or whatever. So you can see that there as well. So it's really interesting that these suddenly show up in the comparisons of the dod and the ra'aya when they are known in Tanakh, when they appear as a pair, as examples of food. How in the world does this image fit the mashal and the deeper meaning of Shir HaShirim? Why does this make any sense? What would you do with this? Why are we comparing them to burgers? Yes, Janine.
Possibly kosher animals are animals that are not, they don't attack other animals and eat other animals.
They're not predatory.
They're not predators, thank you.
Right. We do have that idea certainly regarding birds, right? The kosher birds. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch develops that idea regarding kosher animals in general. The ruminants, he's very into that. They're vegetarian. It's a very interesting idea for sure. I wonder though about the fact that we choose the creatures that are speedy, that are quick. It suggests that there's something about that might be relevant. Yes, Moish. Moish, you're muted.
Animals have the ultimate. They are uncontrolled. They make their own choices.
Mm-hmm. Animals are uncontrolled. They make their own choices. And so the comparison, when she says to her beloved, I want you to be like the tzvi, she's saying, I want you to be uncontrolled.
Well, she's recognizing that he is.
But no, but she calls on him to be. She says, Dimelecha.
I understand what you're saying, but this is poetry, this is literature. So
yeah.
Words aren't as they seem. What she loves about him is being uncontrolled and choosing her.
Interesting. Okay. Could be. That we have two ideas now. One, we have the idea that Janine mentions of not being predatory, and another idea of them being uncontrolled. As I said before, when you're dealing with literary images, you have a lot of freedom to suggest things, and everyone else has a lot of freedom not to accept them. But there's a lot that you can do. The only rule that I would give is that you have to make sure that you're not going to be contradicting Tanakh, because we take it as a given that it's meant to be consistent, not to be inconsistent. So Shir HaShirim Rabbah in the Midrash does the whole literary analysis and offers options that change each time these animals appear, with plays on words on the names of the creatures, the Tzvi and the Ayal, and on the creatures themselves. And if you go back to our Midrash layer that we had back in October, early November, you'll actually see we saw Midrashim that talked about the Tzvi. When we did that. The Malbim says, I think this fits really well into the back and forth of the Seichel HaPoel and the soul. Take a look at source number 3. Malbim says, Domed dodi litzvi ola ofer ha'ayalim, shnehem mitivam, sha'af shemisrachkim chozrim limekomam. The two of them, by nature, even if they go far away, they come back to where they were. V'hatzvi mitiv'o, and the nature of the deer is, shebe'es sherats mabit la'achorav. When it runs, it also looks back. So even if you're going to run away, you're always going to return. And so the Seichel HaPoel, the celestial entity, looks at this world even as it returns to the celestial realm. Now, when he says there's a midrash about the deer looking back as it runs, the only midrashim I could find that relate to that are actually about foxes, not about deer. We have that regarding foxes. You may remember those who learned Shoftim with me, when Shimshon decides to tie the tails of the foxes together because of the way they run, and they'll end up igniting the Philistine fields. But that's Malbim's read. But what I want to show you is a piece by Professor Yehuda Felix. Professor Yehuda Felix was a world-class botanist, and not only in botany, he also wrote on other aspects of nature. And he has a piece here in Shir HaShirim as part of the introduction in the Dat Mikra edition, where he speaks to some of the flora and fauna found in the book. So take a look at source number 4. He says, La'achar sheha ofarim gedelim ve'ozvim es imam. After the young hearts mature and they leave their mothers, hazcharim darim betchila nivdalim en hanekeva usurachokim mehen. So at first, when they're still relatively young, the males reside, that's the typo in my translation, sorry, the males reside apart from the females, far away from them. Kishemagia es hayichum, but when mating season arrives, yotzim hazecharim umushotetim beharim uvagvaos lechapes es begam. Then the males go wandering around in the mountains looking for their mates. Ukshem pokshinosan, and when they find them, eina mischaber mitam miyad. They don't join with them right away. El v'meshach tkufa mesuyemes rodfim b'nei azug ze'achar ze'ah uborchim ze mizeh. There's a courtship that goes on. There's a chasing, and then there's a running away, and a chasing, and a running away. Hatzviva ha'ayal heim... Oh, that's one point. And then his second point. Hatzviva ha'ayal heim ba'alei chayim ha'mitztainim b'yofyam v'gam b'nei emanusam leben zugam. The deer and hart are creatures which stand out for their beauty and for their loyalty to their mate. So, of course, I had to look that up online. I'm not just going to take that as a given. It's an idea we do find in rabbinic commentary. We also find it regarding the dove, the idea that the Jews are compared to the dove because of a monogamy in it. So take a look at source number 5. From deer mating seasons, when do they breed? Website A-to-Z-Animals.com. Like most deer species, white-tailed deer engage in a reproductive strategy called, I don't actually know how it's pronounced, polygyny, I'm guessing, I don't know, in which a dominant male will have multiple female partners. However, the European roe deer is a species that prefers monogamy, mating with only one partner. And the European roe deer, thanks to Wikipedia, I know, lives in the area around the Mediterranean. So the image here is, as Professor Felix suggests, an image of animals that chase and then separate, chase and then separate, much like the entire narrative we're seeing here of God and the Jews coming together and separating, and the image of monogamy as well. It makes sense that Shlomo will want to use this as the model for the relationship between Hashem and the Jews. And now I go back to Sandra's point from when we started today. It would really help me understand this book if, number one, I lived in the world around the Mediterranean, and number two, I was familiar with the animals there. Then I wouldn't need A-to-Z-Animals.com and Wikipedia to explain the metaphor to me. But to those who are living in that environment, this probably helps to make a much more lasting impression on the reader. It's not just God pursues the Jews pursue God, and ultimately they're loyal to each other. It's look at these animals and their behavior. That's what you should have in mind. Yes, Ricky.
And we know that Shlomo knew everything about animals because that is what we learned when we first heard about
them. Very good. In Malachim chapter 5, we talked about Shlomo's knowledge of the animals, King Doolittle. That is correct. Correct. Janine, you were going to say? Or you just... No, okay, Sandra.
The word monogamous sounds almost funny, talking about Shlomo.
Correct, but it's something he very much missed in terms of himself, as he discusses, and we're going to get to in Koheles, God willing, and actually at the end of Mishlei also, I suppose. But keep in mind, this is his ideal image of the relationship between God and the Jews. That's where it is. And frankly, we remember from the 10th, 11th chapter, I should say, in Malachim, that he ran into trouble on the front of monogamy with God as his wives built their idolatrous altars, and he took the hit for it. So I suppose you have that as well. So that's one...
That his marriages to all these princesses of different countries is political.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sorry, I can't hear you well because of the background noise here. Can you be louder?
It's just that it sounds like do as I say, not as I do.
Well, do as I wanted to do is what I would say. As many parents have said to their children over the years, do as I wanted to do. That's one image. The Tzvi Va'ayal, the deer in the heart. Another image that's very, very strong in Shir HaShirim, we talked about it, I think, a little bit in the Medrash layer, is scent, aroma. Very, very powerful throughout Shir HaShirim, and I want to talk it through a little bit. First of all, right at the beginning of the book, but really it comes up quite a bit, we are introduced to Shoshanim. Shoshanat Ha'amakim, in many places. We talk about the Shoshanim. So it's very popular, I'm not even going to ask the question here, it's very popular to translate Shoshana as a rose. Right? That's usually what we say. However, Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra says, it's not a rose. Take a look at source number 6. He doesn't actually say whether it's a rose or not, but what he says makes clear that he's not thinking rose. Shoshanat, source number 6. Yesh omrim, shut semach lavan v'yesh lo reach tov. Some say this is a white plant with a good smell. V'ucham me'od, it is very hot, a term that I don't think refers to actual temperature. Ad shereicho yachiv harosh, to the point where its scent causes a headache. It wafts with such a powerful smell that it can actually give you a headache. V'yitachen liyoso kein yeperusho min shei. She says, if that's true, if that is the correct identification, this flower that we're talking about that's white and has a very strong scent, in that case, the meaning of the word shoshana will come from sheish, which is the number six. Kila olam hi shisha alim levanim, because it always has six white petals. Now, if you know anything about roses, you know that the rose has five petals in the wild, not six. So what we're talking about here is not a rose at all. It also creates a question, which he addresses. What do you mean when you say of your beloved Sifsosav Shoshanim? His lips are as Shoshanim. If they're white, his lips are white. What kind of praise is that? So he says, that's not what it means. V'yaperish Sifsosav Shoshanim bereach lo ba'ayin. When you say his lips are Shoshanim, it means how they smell. Doesn't mean their appearance. So Rebecca writes in the chat, quite correctly, this sounds like a lily. It is not talking about a rose at all. And Professor Felix, to the rescue again, in source number 7, Kavanas haksuvim hile shoshan hatzachor. The text is referring to what's called shoshan hatzachor, which is a white lily. Interestingly, there's another name for it. If you were to look online for the shoshan hatzachor, you would find it's also called a Madonna lily, having to do with Christian artwork. But we're not going there. It's a white lily. Min, as he writes, min lilium. Lo vered, he says. A kind of lily, parentheses, not a rose. Min hayafim v'harechanim shevepirchei habar shel haaretz, among the most beautiful and most aromatic wild flowers in the land. So the, yes, it's a reference to the lily. And the point that I'm bringing this for is not just because it's interesting to look at what the word Shoshana means, although it is, but also because it fits the overall emphasis on scent in Shir HaShirim. You know, Shir HaShirim has a lot in it about scent. I already mentioned that. We're going to see more in just a minute. So using a flower that is known for its aromatic nature makes a lot of sense. I want to keep on the theme of scent and talk about the tapuach. What is tapuach? When we use the term tapuach, we mean an apple, right? That's what we mean when we say tapuach. Elsewhere in Tanakh, outside of Shir HaShirim, what is a tapuach? So in most of Tanakh, tapuach is the name of a place, which is still true in Israel today. Tapuach is usually a place. Twice outside of Shir HaShirim, it shows up in reference to a fruit, twice that I found. One, in the first chapter in Yoel, a passage that is talking about punishment coming. Those who remember Yoel, right, the first half of Yoel, there's a lot of punishment coming. So it talks about the grapevine, the date, the tapuach, and other trees drying up when punishment comes. So that makes it seem like an edible fruit of some kind. It's in a set along with grapes and dates. The other reference is the one that Chana mentioned in the beginning from Mishlei chapter 25:11, Tapuchei Zahav v'maskiyot kesef. Regarding lessons and parables, it talks about gold apples or gold tapuchim in silver settings. So it sounds like from there, again, it's some kind of a fruit, probably round. And then you hit Shir HaShirim. And in Shir HaShirim, we have four references to the tapuach fruit. All but one of them is vague. I gave you the references in source number 8, so you can see it there. The first one, chapter 2, sentence 3, compares the dode to a tapuach, but in a very non-specific way. It just says, "Ketapuach ba'atzei hayar kein dodi bein habanim." Like the tapuach among the trees in the wild, in the forest, so too is my beloved among the young men. So she compares her beloved to an apple tree in the forest. I don't know what that means. Does that mean that he bears fruit in the fall? Like, what does that mean? That she compares him to an apple tree in the forest? I don't know. In chapter 2, sentence 5, so it's just a couple of sentences later, the Ra'aya says, Samchuni bo'ashi shows, support me with grapes. V'rapiduni batapuchim. She wants to be supported, rafida, like to be given like a mat, batapuchim, with tapuchim. Because, ki chalasa ava'ani, because I am lovesick. She doesn't seem to be talking about eating the tapuchim. She wants to lie among the tapuchim. So something is going on here that doesn't seem to be about eating them. First, her beloved is compared to a tapuach tree. Now she wants to lie among the tapuchim. Interesting. We then jump. Chana, I just want to go through the references and then I'll take your comment. If you go to chapter 7, sentence 9, we jump towards the latter part of the book. And the Dod is talking about the Ra'aya. And he says of her, V'reach apeich katapuchim. The smell of your forehead, apeich, I believe, is a forehead or a face, is katapuchim. Your scent is like the tapuach. Now I see it's about scent. Right? That's the first specific read that I actually have, although it fits. Lying among the tapuchim, if it's about smell, is also, like, that's an image I can understand. Comparing him to the tapuach tree, if it has a great scent, also makes sense. The last reference is in chapter 8, sentence 5, where she says she awakened her dod under the tapuach. Which again, if it's something with a nice smell, I can understand as well. Chana, what were you gonna say? No? Okay. So the references here seem to be smell oriented. When we look at the history of translating tapuach, we get some corroborating insight. You see, the meaning of the word tapuach is really not clear. One etymology of the word tapuach could be for something to be round. Nun pei chet can be something that is inflated. A blacksmith is a napach. Something that is bloated like that, a nificha, could be. As a matter of fact, right, in French as well as in Hebrew, right, we use this word to refer to multiple round fruits. Right? How do you say apple in French?
Pomme.
How do you say potato in French?
Pomme de terre.
Pomme de terre. Exactly. In Hebrew, we use tapuach for apple, and for potato, we say tapuach adama. Right? And for orange, we say tapuach zahav. How do you say orange in French?
Orange.
Orange. Right, I knew that. No, that's the color. Is that true for the fruit also?
The same word.
Oh, well. That would have been nice.
Orange is not a color. In French, orange is not a color. If you want to say something is orange, you have to say it's the color of orange.
Interesting. Of orange. Okay. So the point that I'm trying to make is that you could say tapuach just refers to a round fruit. We'll come back to another etymology in a bit. Rabbeinu Tam, Moshe, I see your hand. Are you going to wait a bit, please? If you take a look at source number 9, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that discusses the presentation of the Torah at Sinai. And one of the things that it talks about is the Jews being compared to the tapuach in that our fruit emerges before our leaves emerge. Like we said, Naaseh v'nishma, we will do and we will hear. And Tosfos, Rabbeinu Tam, who's living in Western Europe in the 12th century, says, I don't understand what you're talking about. Since when do apples have the fruit emerge before the leaves? That's not a thing, right? You produce leaves and eventually you produce fruit. So Rabbeinu Tam, in source number 9, answers that tapuach means an esrog. Tapuach refers to an esrog because the esrog stays for multiple seasons on the tree. So it produces leaves, then the fruit comes out, then the leaves go while the fruit stays, and the next season it produces leaves again, but the fruit is there first. So Tosfos says, Rabbeinu Tam says, tapuach actually refers to an esrog. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why people put esrog in charoses. People put esrog in charoses because the line in Shir HaShirim that talks about the association with the tapuach, and we want that association. Rav Soloveitchik is quoted as saying, tapuach in Tanakh is an esrog. It's a very interesting idea. I'm not taking comments yet. I'm sorry, including Moshe in the chat. Now, for a long time, secular scholars, argued that tapuach cannot mean apple. Because, they said, there were no apples in ancient Israel. If you take a look at source number 10, the Jewish Encyclopedia, published in the very beginning of the 20th century, there is perhaps no biblical plant name that has given rise to more discussion than has the identification of the tapuach. 4 distinct fruit-bearing trees, the apple, the citron, the apricot, and the quince, have been suggested as its equivalent. Of these, 2 may be dismissed at once, the apple and the citron. The apple, far from being a native of Palestine, is on account of the tropical climate, but rarely cultivated there, and with no success. The fruit is small, woody, and of very inferior quality. So he doesn't think that it's an apple at all. But a funny thing happens. History catches up with people. In the 1950s, archaeologists discovered apple orchards in Israel that the Romans had destroyed. And apparently, they specifically cultivated aromatic strains. These were fragrant apples. Take a look at source number 11. It's Professor Felix again, this time from his article, Apple, in Encyclopedia Judaica. The tapuach of the Bible has been variously identified as peach, citron, and even mandrake. Yet it undoubtedly refers to the apple. This is confirmed by the references to its characteristics in rabbinic literature. For instance, the season of its ripening, the trees on which grafting would be permitted, the preparation of applesauce and apple cider, etc. In Arabic, the apple is called tufah. In ancient times, the aromatic strains apparently were most widely cultivated, and the odor evoked high praise. So, there's a whole other discussion to be had about why the Christians decided the fruit in the Garden of Eden was an apple. That connects to Shir HaShirim, but I'm not going there right now. My point right now is only to say that since, as we showed in the 4 places it appears in Shir HaShirim, seems to be not about the food as food, but rather about the fruit, about the scent that it emits, the fragrance that it emits, this all fits really, really well. Now I saw, Moish has a note in the chat, about tapuach, if you scramble the letters, being chupah, or chupat. Definitely an interesting point I would not have thought of, so thank you very much, Moish. There was another comment someone wanted to make along the way. No? Okay. The whole book is filled with aromatic things, right? We talk about nerd v'charkom, kanev v'kinamon, all of these different perfumes and spices. So here's the question, after all of that. Why so much about scent? Why does this book spend so much time talking about smells? What's the nimshal? How does this work as a metaphor? So I would suggest... Yeah, Chana?
Is it because the Avodat Hashem ktoret and things, maybe?
We use scent in the service of Hashem with incense, that is true.
Is scent considered one of the highest of the faculties?
Yes. Highest in the sense of spiritual.
Spiritual,
it's
yes.
A spiritual faculty. It's considered pure, as opposed to physical contact or taste, things like that, that are more material. this is considered to be more spiritual. Also, it is sensed even at a distance, which there often is between the dod and the ra'aya. Right? Even at a remove, there's still the possibility of smelling them. So I think it fits the, you know, it fits as a part of a nice, beautiful image, but it also fits the deeper layer of, layers of meaning in terms of our relationship with Hashem. And let's not forget Tapuach and Chuppah. Thank you, Moshe. Okay. We've got 10 minutes, so I'm going to start on something else that isn't about the natural imagery. This draws on an article by Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein from a series that they have in the virtual Beit Midrash of Yeshivat Haaretz Yom, the Israel Koshitsky virtual Beit Midrash. It's a series on Haftarot. So this is an article for Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach, because, you know, that's when we read Shir HaShirim publicly. Apparently, it was originally in Hebrew. I don't have access to the original. I haven't found the original, I should say. But they have online the translation by a fellow named David Strauss, and I gave you the link in source number 12. If anybody wants to read the full article, we're not going to get to complete it this week. We're going to start on it, and hopefully it'll be part of what we discuss next week. Rabbi Lichtenstein picks up on the ways that the Dod and the Ra'aya describe each other. So we're going to start him this week and we'll continue it next week. The theme of the book, as he reads it, and it's not a novelty, is the Ra'aya's pursuit of the Dod and the Dod's love for the Ra'aya. In his explanation, the Ra'aya is us and the Dod is God. Classic approach, right? Nothing novel in that. But he throws in a very interesting idea that we've sort of seen hinted at, but he goes in a little bit of a different direction. He suggests that the reason the Dod is distant from the Ra'aya, even though the Ra'aya clearly loves him, is because she is so stormy and impetuous. She needs to grow, she needs to stabilize before they can be in a relationship. That's what he says is going on. She's all about pursuing him, and he's like, no, not yet, not yet. You have to mature first. Take a look at source number 13, please. He writes, she is confused and frustrated. Why doesn't he reveal himself to her and immediately take her as his bride? The answer to this question lies in the personality of the Ra'aya. Her entire being is a bursting emotional storm. She does not think out her steps, but leaps forward in a torrent of stormy love. There is no calculation of gradual and progressive measures, nor is there development and deepening of the relationship over time, but a wild rush forward along a path that ascends to the heights of holy love. These are the distinguishing These are the distinguishing features of the Ra'aya. They are what drive her to cling to her beloved Dod and pursue him at all times, but they also constitute an obstacle and stumbling block on the road to actualizing her love for the Dod. You follow? And then he gives you examples. He says, well, first of all, he picks up on something. This is something that I'm not good with. But remember the Hishbati oath? I make you swear not to awaken the love before its time. So we showed that according to Rashi, according to Ibn Ezra, according to Malbim, the speaker in that oath, the Hishbati oath, is spoken by the Ra'aya to the daughters of Jerusalem, whoever those are, depending on your explanation. That's not the way he reads it. He reads it that the speaker is the Dod. And he's talking to her. That's the way he reads it. Interestingly, that's the reading of the Gemara in Ksuvos, which goes in a different direction. But take a look at the second paragraph in source number 13. As stated above, the Ra'aya bursts forward with no restraints, and the Dod tries to calm her down and put her to ease in order to allow for their love to deepen in a gradual manner. This finds expression in two ways. First, the Dod explicitly declares this grand principle, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the fields. Now it's not a hart, it's a hind. Fine. That you stir not up, nor awake my love till it please. In the previous verse, the Raya had stormily proclaimed, I am sick with love. And from this she concluded she was facing a situation of his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. The Doe therefore cries out and clarifies that her longings have outpaced for the time being reality, and that love should not be stirred up prematurely. Similar circumstances prevail also the second time that the Doe charges the daughters of Jerusalem, and immediately afterwards we are informed that 60 men surround Shlomo's litter, i.e. his bed is guarded against the Ra'aya, so that she should not be able to burst in to his room. That's the way that he reads this. And he concludes the section by saying, in addition to the explicit declaration of the differences between the two heroes in the story, the book of Shir HaShirim deepens our awareness of the issue by employing literary devices that illustrate and flesh out these characteristics. We shall try here to exemplify this idea as it finds expression in two elements in the book, namely, the role of time and the literary images as they are expressed by the Dode and, the Ra'aya. So he says, I'm going to show you what I mean when I say that she is too passionate, that she's not stable in her pursuit of the Dode. He says, look at the way that time is used here. If you take a look at source number 14, I bring you from his essay. The Ra'aya, physically and emotionally drained by her restless running after the Dode under the burning afternoon sun and late at night, you can see the verses he gave you the references, in an intensive search before its time, fails to get up to open the door for the Dode when the great and long-awaited moment finally arrives. She's pursuing him, and then when he comes for her, suddenly she's not ready. And she's pursuing around the clock. She's pursuing in the afternoon. She's pursuing at night. And then you get this great line. Already at the beginning of the Ra'aya's courtings, she directs a question to the Dode. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where Echa Tireh, Echa Tarbitz Batzaharayim, where you make your flock to rest at noon. She wants to find him in the middle of the day while he's out with the animals. The simple fact that the Ra'aya tries to reach the Dode too soon is reinforced by the emphasis placed on the time. When does she desire to see him? In the middle of the day. Surely that is time for work, not for pleasure. During the day we work. It is at night that we conduct our social and love life. At that early stage of the relationship that is growing between them, she should not abandon everything and chase after him in the middle of the workday. Day is for work, night for courting. But the Ra'aya pays no attention. She has an impulsive personality. She therefore puts everything aside and runs out to find him. The answer does not tarry. He says to her, go your way forth by the footsteps of the flock. Feed your kids, the young goats, beside the shepherd's tents. Or in other words, calm down and return to your work. The time will yet come when it will be appropriate for the Ra'aya to be with the Dode in the middle of the day, but not now. When a relationship is first being created and established, the work of love should be pursued at night, not during the day. The Dode will indeed come, but with the dampness of night and not in the afternoon sun. So her pursuit of the Dode by day is flagged as inappropriate, and so he tells her that she should go away. So that's an example of analyzing a literary device here, the way that time is used in order to underscore the message. And where it really becomes interesting, and this is the part that I'm going to challenge, but is when he talks about the images that the Dode and the Ra'aya use to describe each other. So that's what we're going to pick up with, God willing, next time. We're going to see Rabbi Lichtenstein's read. We're also going to see Professor Eliyahu Assis from Bar-Ilan University and a layer that he reads into the back and forth. There are a few things that we want to pick up in the literary layer. I also want to be able to do a summary of what we've said in our 11 weeks on Shir HaShirim. So I want to do that also next week. And then again, as I said in the beginning, after our 2-week break, we're going to look at Mishlei, at Proverbs. I don't think we're going to spend 11 weeks on Mishlei, because I think I want more than 11 for Koheles. But we'll have to see. All God willing, in good time. Okay? Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Be well. Have a good week.
Thank you.